Hi, my name is Tomasz Wiśniewski. This is another episode of Tydzień z Azure for the English-speaking viewers, which means Week with Azure. It's a weekly show where we talk about Azure news, and today we have a special guest all the way from the from Australia, Troy Hunt. Troy, can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi Thomas. Thank you. I have come all the way from Australia onto the internet, which is a big trip for me. Everywhere is a long way from Australia, even the internet. Yeah. So I'm coming to you by my super fast maximum 20 megabit speed, which is really kind of depressing. But hopefully it works. So I am Troy Hunt. I am I'm a Pluralsight author. The primary thing I do is I write courses for Pluralsight, and I travel around the world lately doing talks and workshops as well. And I'm a Microsoft MVP for developer security for about the last 5 years, I think, as well. So I write a lot about security. I do a lot of training on security, but I also do a lot of cloud things as well. So I do a lot with Azure, which I assume is probably why I'm here today.
Exactly.
And I particularly like it when I can find a way to use Azure for security things, which I'm sure we'll talk about as well.
Nice. Security MVP is quite rare. How many are there in the world? Do you know, maybe?
Yeah, we're actually quite special. There are some enterprise security MVPs, some developer security MVPs. Of the group that I normally socialize with, there's probably only sort of half a dozen to a dozen sort of active MVPs. It's not sort of like ASP.NET or Internet Explorer or any of those groups that seem to be pretty well populated. So I don't know if that makes us special or if it just means that security is a bit unloved. Maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah, probably. Okay, thank you very much, Troy. So let's get to the news that we have for this week. First thing is Elastic Database Query. Many of you, probably you also, Troy, use SQL database in Azure for your projects. I do for mine because it is a very cool database. And one of the things that came up recently is when you have a lot of databases. For example, you have customers for whom you provide some, let's say, e-commerce site. The database has a very similar schema, and you want to query all the databases. And now you can do it with the one single connection, and you can query all the database, which makes it very easy. And then you can supply it, for example, to a BI system of your choosing to get that data. So pretty cool feature, which is now available in preview in the current version, which is very nice.
Okay, you know, I think what's cool about this is the sort of scale stuff you can do with this is pretty awesome. And it's almost like I sort of made a note here, it's scale as a service. Yeah. You know, I mean, think about what you can do. I mean, most of the cloud offerings, whether they be from Microsoft or other providers as well, they blow my mind every time you create something and you go, holy crap, I just made something that in very recent memory was actually a lot of effort, and it involved boxes and lights and cables. And what I like about things like Elastic Database Query is that it's taking things that were lots and lots of boxes and cables. I mean, it was a lot of investment in order to build this physical infrastructure. And it was a very long-term investment too, right? You had to be there for the long term in order to recoup the gains recoup the expenses of building that stuff. And to be able to go into the portal now and just keep turning up the dial to get the sort of scale you want is amazing.
Yes, that's exactly very well put. Please follow the documentation. You can sign up for the preview and see how it works. The second thing is Docker. Before we get to the news, what is your opinion on Docker? Because I know there are some mixed feelings in the industry about the container apps and all the all the hype that is going around it.
So I think probably the most easily immutable opinion that I have is that a lot of people are talking about it. Like it or not, Docker is a really hot topic. But I think the paradigm, if you like, of containerized applications that are small enough that they're not sort of virtualized machines, but they are sort of logical apps that can be much more easily spun up, discarded, replicated than what an entire virtualized environment would be. I like this idea. I like the idea of componentizing things. And we might talk a little bit more about that later on with my approach to that too. Mm-hmm. So that as a paradigm is really good. I like the way that, that Microsoft is sort of now starting to embrace Docker, and I mean, indeed, they started supporting the Docker extensions last year anyway, but embracing that rather than saying, let us go off and build our own thing is a positive thing. It's probably another sign of the new Microsoft as we know it now. Now, whether or not Docker is the right model or not is yet to be seen, but this is something that's pretty new, right? And it's evolving really quickly too. So I think it's good that there's support for it. As the right thing at the right time, we'll see what the right thing is next year, the year after. There'll be something else cool then, and we'll have moved on. Yeah. But we'll see.
Yeah, and one thing again before the news itself, it's good that it's not enforced on you. Yes, it's one of the options you have to choose on Azure. You don't have to use it, but you can use it with very good integration. And that's what this news item from last week is about. We'll be deploying a new Docker Hub extensions. If you are using virtual machines, you probably know extensions which can be installed on that virtual machines, and a new version of Docker extension is being introduced here with cool two new features and one extra feature. The first one is integration with Docker Hub. If you like the Docker registry, you can provide your own credential which will be the default for the extension, and also you can use Docker Compose, which will create pretty fine set of containers for your Docker, and you can also use some advanced configuration. So that's the three main features. And which is very,
you know, I really like the idea of Compose insofar as you might define a set of containers that need to work together, and this is your definition of an environment, and you just roll it out.
Yeah.
I was a little surprised to see that on the Docker Compose website they're saying, you know, this is really good. We suggest you don't use it for production. So I sort of it always sort of puts just that little bit of doubt in your mind as to what the maturity level is when they say, you know, play with it and test it, but maybe not create dependencies that might break things in a real environment. But you know, hopefully that's something that's heading in the right direction, and that will evolve a little bit, and it will be something that we do in production environments.
Yes, and Docker is an open source project. You know, it evolves very rapidly, and I think it will be on right level support in the near future. And also what's important that the current extension will be removed from the system on the 1st of December this year. So remember that date. We'll probably remind you again, our viewers, about that date later this year. And the last news from this week is the new preview portal improvements. You want to start with this, Troy?
Yeah. Now, hey, I'm glad you sent me this, because it explains why I kept seeing new things in my portal recently. And I mean, having said that, we're used to seeing new things in Azure, right? And we almost joke about it sometimes, where you go back into the portal and you go, oh, look at that. That wasn't there yesterday.
Yeah,
and the funny thing about it is it can be either unsettling and disruptive to some people, and it's... I'm not sure if in Polish you have the same saying, or if you're familiar with the English saying of someone moving your cheese, where the environment that you're in keeps changing, and some people are very uncomfortable with change, and other people embrace it and they're very excited about it and they make the most of it. And changes like this, actually, I think are a good balance, because it's not something that makes you work differently. So, you know, I'm looking at my portal now and I'm seeing changes like the breadcrumbs. The breadcrumb wasn't there before. And I'm in Microsoft Azure, browse all resources, my Have I Been Pwned site, into my metrics, into my edit chart. And I like the way I can drill back through there, but if somebody who doesn't like cheese being moved saw this, I don't think they'd be too upset. It's pretty self-explanatory. So, you know, that's pretty cool. The other thing that I'm finding really useful as well is actually pinning stuff to the start board and trying to save myself the labor of drilling down, because let's face it, there are a lot of things on the portal. A lot of us have a lot of things in our subscriptions. And every time I needed to get something like, what's the current CPU utilization on my web server, I'd be drilling down and taking multiple steps. And I'm just starting to pin that stuff to the start board now, because this new customization feature, which has brought stuff that was there before, but just brought it to the forefront, if you like, makes it very easy. So I'm trying to pick the things that are really relevant for me, and creating a start board that looks a little bit like the Starship Enterprise mine at the moment, because I've got I've got so many different things that I want to see at the same time, because I want to see my CPU utilization and my requests, and I also want to see the table storage transactions and the data, and I want to see all of this in one place. So it's really cool to be able to do that now. And I think one thing that's really worthwhile people drilling down into is how you can customize these, and also how you can actually change the layout even within a blade.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
You can go into a blade, like say your web server blade, and say, look, I want to have a link through to the console here, and I want to have these metrics and these charts, and make it work for you so that you have to work less, which is a good thing.
Yeah. And from the new features, one of my favorite new features is the refresh button in the browse blade, because especially when you are a speaker, when you are doing live demos and you create something, up till last week you had to refresh the whole portal, which was not very convenient, and now you just click the refresh button, you can get all the new items in your repository of, let's say, virtual machines. So so that's pretty cool for me.
I think it's pretty amazing when you think about what we can do with web software, right? Like you look at this, and you know, a lot of people probably remember back to those years, maybe even as recent as 5 years ago, certainly like 10 years ago, all these arguments of, you know, well, can we really build a web app, or do we need a rich client app? Because it needs to do a lot. It needs to have a lot of functionality. And look at how much is happening in this portal. It's insane. And you know, the other thing I've noticed, I'm pulling out my iPad as well, it actually works really, really nicely on the iPad now, which is pretty cool, because it didn't used to do that until very, very recently. And I like that, because often when I'm mobile, I just want to be able to pull this thing out and make it work.
Mm-hmm.
I'd really like you to make it work on the iPhone as well. I'll be really happy when I can redeploy on the fly from my iPhone, which you can do with the old portal, but not the new portal.
Yeah. Well, the iPhone form factor is quite challenging, I must say, for that kind of scenarios and stuff you want to do. But probably the team will listen to your feedback. That's one important thing that I think needs to be mentioned with this portal. All of the new features come mostly from the feedback that people put on user voice. So that's a big change also in Microsoft culture, that we listen a lot more to our customers and people who use the products every day, so they can tell us what they want and how we can prioritize our stuff in the development.
You've got smart people. You'll work it out. Come.
Always listen to the people and your customers. That's the first thing. So from the other interesting stuff and improvements, I think creating empty resource groups is pretty nice. I like that, because I with the Azure Resource Manager now as the primary API for Azure, it's a good feature. And also, it's not directly related to the new portal, but probably when you look through GitHub or the Azure.com portal, you can see this magic button deploy to Azure, which can deploy the Azure Resource Manager templates directly into your subscription. It is a very cool feature, I think many people will start to use in the future, because it makes...
I was actually looking at the Ghost blog engine yesterday, because my wife needs a blog, and I was looking at that going, wow, that'd be really easy. Just press a button and I've got Ghost.
Yeah.
And then I have to look after it for my wife. So we might actually go down a hosted model. But I really like the idea of that. I'm actually getting a bit tempted to do that with my own blog.
Yeah. So pretty cool stuff. Okay, so that's all the news we had for this week, and we have one special segment from Troy, because many of you maybe know this site and know Troy because of that site. Have I Been Pwned? Can you briefly describe what's the site about for people who may not know?
Yeah, good question. So haveibeenpwned.com, and I'm sure you'll put a link to that in the notes, because the spelling is a bit ambiguous. So this is a site that I set up late in 2013, and it sort of brought together the two things I was describing that I enjoy so much, being the security side of things and also the cloud, and particularly cloud scale. And you know, why I wanted to do this is I was seeing a lot of data breaches online and doing a lot of analysis on them, and I'd keep seeing the same people in multiple data breaches. And I was thinking, you know, I wonder if this guy knows. He's in like the Stratfor data breach and the Adobe data breach, and you combine these things together and you actually get some useful information, particularly for people who may have the attacker hat on, some very useful info. So I thought it'd be interesting to have a service where you could search across all the places that you've been compromised or pwned, as the term often is. And at the time, I was doing a lot of work with Azure as well. And I thought, hey, this would be a really good Azure project because we're talking about a lot of data. So the Adobe breach on its own was 152 million records. And it is interesting. It is a lot of data. I mean, it's still the it's certainly the largest publicly dumped data breach that's happened. And it's an interesting sort of engineering challenge to say, how can I take that much data, so a large volume, and make it super, super fast to search, and keep it cheap and have it scale. And all of these objectives together have, you know, over the last, I guess just over 18 months, have made for a really interesting challenge for me. So I've now got about 200 million records in this system. And I've had really, really interesting challenges around things like my sort of stable volume when I first started might have been a couple of thousand people a day come and have a look. And then it would hit the news, and it's been in just about every news publication you can think of, including things like Time Magazine and Wall Street Journal. It's just had massive press. So it'd be really, really stable, and then suddenly there'd be 150,000 people overnight come and look at the site, which is just a perfect use case for cloud scale. And one of the things that was really interesting for me is how do we optimize this thing in order to support that kind of growth? So I learned a lot of hard things very early on. So I learned things like always max out the number of instances you can auto-scale to. Don't set it at 3. Because if you go to bed and you're wildly successful, which is a lovely problem to have, you want to be able to support the traffic. And the reality of it is an extra 7 instances for the period of some number of hours until you realize it really costs negligible money anyway, so you might as well just let the thing scale and then figure out what to do with it if you remain wildly successful. So that, you know, that was one of the interesting lessons I learned very early on. Another very interesting lesson is to shuffle your bandwidth costs off to CDNs, public CDNs. So I found that in one day I served about, I think it was about 35 gigabytes worth of jQuery. And I paid 35 gigabytes worth of jQuery, which is not that much money. But I looked at it and went, well, I don't have to pay for this. So I used the Cloudflare CDN to serve all of my public libraries. So that now, you know, that now goes onto their bill, and it's distributed around the world too. So I still only have one single instance of a data center. I'm not using Traffic Manager and spreading it out around the world. So when I put that with Cloudflare, then they pay for it. And plus, if anyone's been to another site that uses that CDN, then they get those assets loaded already, and that might even just pull from cache. So that was an interesting exercise early on. One of the really interesting challenges for me has been, how can I keep this just ridiculously cheap? So how can I keep much cheaper than what I need to be? Now, I don't make any money out of it other than donations. And the donations are nice, and they sort of cover my coffee, which is good. And I've needed a lot of coffee to get this done too, I'll tell you what. but, you know, I just found it as an interesting exercise to say, how can I keep it cheap? So a really good example of that is I use table storage in the back end. And table storage is fantastic when you use it well, and it's terrible when you use it badly. And what I mean by that is that if you use it as effectively a key value store and you partition well, it is really cheap and really fast and absolutely sensational. But if you try to query it like a relational database management system, it's terrible. It kills you. So, you know, to put this in context, so for that couple of hundred million records I have in there, there's about 16 gigabytes worth of data in storage. And I have somewhere in the order, it depends month by month, I have about 25 million transactions. One of the recent months I looked at, about 25 million transactions to the database, or rather to table storage. And it cost me about $2.50 for the month. And that is really cool. You know, like if I had have done that on, say, the SQL Azure offering as a relational database system, I would have had to pay a lot of money to get that sort of performance, because the performance is down as low as 4 milliseconds sometimes. I actually have to slow the process down on the client using JavaScript, because otherwise people go, well, this isn't real. I actually put a timeout in there to go, make sure there's enough time that the bar comes down and then it goes up again and people can visually see it. So I like the fact that I've had to do that.
If we are on the subject of cost, can you share how much does it cost you a month, or it's, or is it a secret that you want to keep for yourself?
Well, it always fluctuates a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. And it, part of the reason it fluctuates is that, in fact, I make my traffic volumes public now. And if you go to the site about and you go to status and you have a look at it, inevitably, like I'm looking at it now and it's sitting at around 120 requests a minute, which is just organic traffic. Mm-hmm. And there's a spike in there in the last half hour where it went to nearly 2,000 requests a minute. I look back at my last week of traffic and there was an hour there where it averaged nearly 8,000 requests a minute. Mm-hmm. And you know, sometimes it'll be 15, 20,000 requests a minute because there's an API and someone decides they want to scan the API and it goes nuts. And then auto-scale happens and all these other things happen to support it, which is why it goes up and down a lot. But the guidance that I normally give is it costs me less than what it costs, less than what I spend on coffee. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, that may mean that I'm drinking too much coffee. That's a possibility. But as a guideline...
where do you get it? That's another thing.
Well, it's about $4 for a takeaway cappuccino here. That's for Australian dollars, which is a lot less than American dollars now. And let's imagine I had a couple of those a day, and you can do the math. It's still cheap. And in fact, it's funny because often I'll have people come to me and say, look, we want to sort of scan our client base, but we're really worried about costing you too much money or impacting your performance. And I try to be really polite and not laugh too much. And then I point at the stats and say, do you know how much performance I can get out of this thing? Because if I'm serving 8,000 requests a minute off a single instance and it will scale out to 10, if you can throw 80,000 requests at it a minute, I'd be really, really impressed. But you're going to need some serious pipes in order to do that.
Well, we'll probably use another Azure instances to do that.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. It'll scale out. And one of the challenges that I'm dealing with at the moment is how do I get the right auto-scale metrics? Because my auto-scale by CPU is not really working very well at the moment. So I'm looking at things like HTTP queue links and disk queue links and things like that, trying to find what's the right sweet spot where I serve data as fast as possible and I scale up as fast as possible, but I don't sort of scale too early. And in some of the blog posts I've written, and if anyone goes through the Have I Been Pwned tag on my blog, you'll see that there's been times where I've gotten auto scale wrong. And there's actually a graph that just goes like this the whole time, mm-hmm. where it's just bouncing, okay, one more instance, oh, now it's too much and take it away. Now it's not enough and add it back on. So you got to sort of find a sweet spot there, and it's going to be different for every app too. So that makes a really interesting challenge. One of the other things that I've done that a lot of people sort of went, you can't do this, is I have both table storage and I have a SQL database, or rather I have a SQL Azure database service. And many people are in the mindset that you choose a database and that is it, and you work with that database and you live with your choice. And I think that that's really not a very pragmatic way of doing it. So I started with table storage, but I also started with a relational database because there are times where I have classes of data that I want to query. Mm-hmm. So for example, you can subscribe to the service and get an email notification when you appear in a breach. And I need to keep track of who has appeared in what breaches so that I can keep track of who I've sent notifications to so I don't double up. I've got good item potency on that. And relational databases are very good for doing that. There's not a lot of data, there's not a lot of load on it, and there are a lot of things that actually don't have to be very fast when their background process is looking at whether someone's appeared in a new breach. So finding the right balance between mm-hmm. these things, and then in some cases even doing things like denormalizing the database a little bit because it makes it faster at the point where someone actually needs to read from it, mm-hmm. and then I wear a little bit of cost on the writes or some other back-end process, well, fine, but you've got to sort of let go of some very traditional views of the way information should be structured in order to do that.
Great. So I have one more question. Where do you get all the databases of Pwned accounts?
Yeah, good question. So I tell you what's interesting about it. I often have people email me. In fact, I'm looking at an email on my other screen right now where they say, so I've just broken into a system and I've got all this data. Would you like it? Okay. Oh, jeez. All right. First of all, stop breaking into systems. but look, the view that I take with it is if a system has already been compromised and data has been released publicly, or certainly at the very least the compromise has been acknowledged and reported, then there is an opportunity there to provide a service where people can learn about the fact that they've been impacted. So the first thing is that I'm really, really explicit. If anyone comes to me and says, I've got data that I want to give you, it's like, you know, no, unless it's in the public domain, and that's not a reason to go and dump it into the public domain either, I don't take it. So, look, if we take something like a few weeks ago, there was the Adult Friend Finder data breach. So this was the hookup site for people looking for sex. There were about 4 million records dumped. They are all shared publicly on a Tor hidden service. It's a hidden service, but anyone can access it over Tor. In a case like that, there are a number of people that said, hey, there's data over here that might be relevant to your site, because I've got a lot of sort of helpful followers. In other cases, there's a lot of data that is distributed over torrents. So a good example is just within the last sort of 6 or 7 hours, there's been a major data breach of a hacking organization, an Italian hacking organization of questionable repute, and there's 400 gigabytes worth of data sitting on torrents now. So all of that data is just put out there in the public by people who have different motivations. In the case of Sony, it was, you know, obviously DPRK that decided to leak it, and they had their motivations, which is different to a script kiddie wanting to build a reputation. But bottom line is, it's data out there in the public, and that's where I get it from.
Cool. And what is your process of getting that data into the system? Because it may come in different formats, in, you know, different files. How do you get that into your table storage?
Yeah, good question. So I actually class the data in two different categories. So I started out with breaches, things like Adobe. And in a case like that, one of the things I'm pretty adamant about is actually verifying that the data is legitimate. Because there are a lot of breaches out there which aren't real breaches. They're just copies of something. So I have various processes of validating it's correct. And when I know that it is correct and it is legitimate, I actually upload a zip into Blob Storage. And then I've got a web job that looks for a new file in Blob Storage. It picks up that zip and then it processes it all within the web job. And what it actually does is it goes through the zip file and it bulk loads into SQL Server, or into my SQL Azure database service. Bulk loads into there, and then it queues up all of these other jobs that go through and actually process segments of it. So it's kind of an odd architecture, but it effectively divides and conquers, and it puts a lot of the workload, or rather it puts one bulk of workload first, and it's fast to load into bulk load into SQL Server, and then it delegates out to all these web jobs, because the web jobs scale out multiple times on the one instance, then you can scale out multiple instances, and I can effectively massively parallelize that load. So that's how that one works. And then I've got another class of data, which is PACE. And PACE, it's basically just text dumped onto somewhere like Pastebin. And I've got monitors that go through and look for that automatically. In fact, I've got web jobs that go through and monitor that. And when something appears there, it automatically picks it up and loads it into table storage. But you don't necessarily know whether it's a legitimate breach or not. It's, there's lots of caveats there. But it is your email address or someone's email address appearing on a public forum somewhere, usually without their knowledge. So, you know, then people will get notifications, and all of that is orchestrated via web jobs as well.
Cool. Maybe the last question I have for you today, have you found your emails in any of these breaches?
Yes, in fact, so I have. I had 3 email addresses in Adobe. Most people are in Adobe because that's where the 152 million emails was. So I had my personal one, my work one, and another shared work one, all in Adobe. And I'm under no illusions that I will find myself in subsequent data breaches. And for everyone else listening to this, go and sign up to the subscriptions. It's absolutely free. And then if you are found in a subsequent data breach or a paste, you'll get an email as soon as it happens, which is usually a long time before the impacted site actually lets you know.
Cool. That's a very good tip for the end. So thank you, Troy, for your co-hosting today. It's been very interesting to see a real-world project which is worldwide known, which scales, auto-scales, when you use different Azure components. It's really interesting. I think the viewers will love to see that. And thank you very much again.
Cool. Thanks, Thomas.